suggesting that these young people from Europe or Egypt or wherever come to the U.S., they thought I was nuts.
I'm James Hoog, and this is Outside the Glass. Jack Wyant is the director of squash and the head coach of the women's team at the University of Pennsylvania. It's a milestone moment for Jack. He's in the midst of his 20th season at Penn, and last month he turned 50, so it felt like it was time to sit down with my longtime neighbor here in Delaware. Jack grew up in Cincinnati, was a top junior at Princeton. He was a member of the Tiger team that won the national title in 1993 under Bob Callahan, and he was a captain for 3 seasons. After coaching a year at Milton, Wyant came to Philadelphia, and in these 20 years, he has always coached the Quaker women, and as well for 6 seasons after Craig Thorpe Clark and before Gilly Lane, he also coached the men. Jack's also coached the U.S. National Women's Junior Team in Chennai in India in 2009 and in Boston in 2011. Jack's always been a strong advocate for change in the college game. And here he quotes some surprising statistics about the growth in the past 40 years of two similar sports, lacrosse and rowing, that speak to the opportunities squash might have squandered in the past and yet might take advantage of in the future.
Thanks for having me, Jim. This is great. I love your podcast. I have a commute to work, and you help me get there once a month, which is great. So I was lucky enough to play for Bob at Princeton. He was an extremely competitive guy, but just was the perfect kind of father figure for those college years, where he gave you some rope, but also wasn't afraid to discipline us when we got into trouble, which was pretty regularly. I think about him every time we have a home match, because I throw on a tie, which is something I do because we get to wear a sweatshirt to work every other day of the week, and Bob always wore ties to matches, which I think is his way to say, okay, boys, this is business. This is a serious occasion.
Yeah.
And we're going to get dressed up for it in a small way. So I think of him every time we have a match, and you know, miss him. He was just a great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever think, you know, there are kids like this who are like, they want to get into it as a, you know, like when you were playing, you weren't like, oh, I'm going to be a coach one day. I'm going to coach against Bob Callahan. Like,
no, I did not ever think that. I just knew that I loved squash. I remember, I mean, we're bouncing around, but I remember when I was 10 years old, my junior coach, Don Mills, I grew up in Cincinnati. He signed me up for an adult men's tournament in Cleveland, Ohio. And you would know the details, but Hambiger had a WPSA tournament in Cleveland, and it was the same weekend. So I got to see Mark Talbot and Ned and John Nimick play, Mauricio Sanchez. I know Jehinger wasn't there, but it was really cool at age, I don't know, 12 or 13 to see squash at the professional level in America. So I did have an idea that maybe someday I would like, if I continued to be pretty decent at squash, that I could potentially play after college, certainly in college, but maybe after college. And then my route was I tried PSA after graduating from college, had a little bit of success, but not much, having grown up with the hardball till I was about 15 years old. So it was really more of just a learning experience for me. And then, and I guess I was 23 or 4 and made the decision that I need to grow up and get a real job, which I tried to do that for 3 or 4 years and learned a lot of things in marketing and some other places, but really just missed being around the game.
Yeah.
And had, given that I was lucky enough to play junior squash, college squash, and then a bit on the PSA tour, there was no doubt in my mind that I wanted to end up in college squash. I grew up playing a lot of team sports, baseball, soccer, a little bit of basketball, and thought that the combination of our sport, squash, in a team setting was the most exciting, the most fun, you know, the only possible drawback is that you don't get the relation, you don't get the opportunity to mentor young people from the time that they start the game until they, you know, grow older.
Yeah.
But other than that, I just thought this is the place to be. And so I quit my job in Cincinnati around the age of 29 and then was lucky to get hired by, I tried to get a job at your alma mater, Dartmouth, but they hired Martin Heath's brother, David, who was a better candidate for them at the time. And so then I went.
Had a better accent.
Yes, for sure. And a better player, most definitely, and a great guy. But then started looking at high schools and ended up working at Milton Academy for a year. Had a great experience.
What just about Milton, Frank Millett was the legend there. What did you get? I mean, you were only there 1 year, but like, what did you get out of Frank in the 1 year?
Well, he was extremely welcoming and nice, and I was basically shot out of a cannon. I was so excited. The reason I took the job at Milton Academy was because there were a number of, I wasn't focused on coaching boys or girls, but I took the job at Milton because they, at the time, Chris Barr had done a great job building up the program in Boston, and a lot of his top junior kids were students at Milton Academy. So they had national rankings, and I thought, well, what's better? I'm not going to mention the other schools, but should I go coach at this boarding school where the kids are learning the game, or go to Milton where there are a bunch of girls that are really good? I mean, right. CeCe Cortez was there. I mean, a bunch of really good players. And so, of course, I took the Milton job. So I'm there. I'm giving individual sessions in addition to the whatever, the afternoon practices. And Mr. Millett was like, what is this guy? He's nuts. But he was extremely warm and welcoming, yeah. And he used to just kind of wander through the facility every day and
check on things.
Yeah, check on things, you know, but very encouraging. Yeah. And I guess in the back of my mind, if he can be at Milton Academy teaching English, did he teach English?
Latin
and coaching squash for
60 some odd years.
Then maybe there's a way I can
stay in the game.
Yeah, stay in the game for a while. Yeah, and then after 1 year, the Penn job opened up, and I didn't really think I had a legitimate shot at getting it, but I applied, and I do remember in the interviews I was pretty much shot out of a cannon. I had big plans, lofty goals. From our athletic director's perspective, I don't think I cost a lot of money versus some other candidates. And somehow I was hired in, what was that, 2004?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you know, you had 1 year of experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of things that are good about being involved with a niche sport, and that's one of them. Because you're right. I mean, if I compare my experience, compared to the football coaches at Penn, right. or
you know, basketball,
lacrosse, yeah. Any other sport. I mean, these coaches have to pay their dues. Now, having said that, I never really left the game. I mean, I think what was appealing was the fact that I had some marketing experience or some experience in business.
Right.
I had played in the U.S. They didn't need to get me a visa. That was also probably something that Penn might have considered. But so I'm sure they would have preferred that I had more experience, but also our athletic director at the time, Steve Bilski, I think he loved trying to find people that were passionate about winning and kind of maybe a little bit of the underdog or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's amazing. If you look at other college programs, like, yeah, 1 year of high school experience. I mean, you had played the pro tour. Did you work at summer camps? Did you work at Edison?
I was working for Gale the summer that I was hired. So the summer in between Milton and summer of 2004, Gale brought me in to do a couple weeks there.
Yeah.
So I was obviously just coaching to make ends meet. Yeah. And then I remember Craig Thorpe Clark, who was the men's coach at Penn.
Yeah.
Gilly's coach, among a lot of other good friends. He drove to Princeton to interview me for Penn. Yeah, so I did a Penn interview on Princeton's campus. Kind of strange.
And so were you succeeding? Who was the women's?
Jim Martell. So it was Ann Wetzel,
yeah.
Then Demmer, then Jim Martell.
Okay. for the women.
Correct.
And who? And Craig was the man.
Craig was the men's
coach. He was still the men's coach when when you started.
Yeah, he was the coach there for 6 years.
Yeah.
And then he retired, or not retired, but left.
Yeah.
I put my name in to do both programs, which is what a lot of schools decide is the way to go.
Yeah.
Did that for 6 years. That coincided with us having three children. And I guess maybe this is a question you'll get to, but I'm happy to share why we split the programs up again.
Right.
Simple. Two reasons. One, I hired Gilly as an assistant. It was clear from day one that he was going to be a great head coach. Yeah. And from a bigger picture perspective, I just didn't feel we would have matches. I mean, I remember some against your alma mater where that was a huge match for us on the men's side. Yeah. And I would be solely focused on that match. And then we would play against, the same weekend, let's say we're playing against Harvard. And that was a much bigger match for the women because they had a legitimate chance to win that, whereas maybe the men didn't. So I'm focused on this. And I'm thinking on the bus ride home one day, this is so weird. Like, what would the basketball coaches ever have to pick and choose? No chance.
No chance.
And so I went back to the athletic director and sort of proposed a split.
Yeah. But it's interesting because the trend, in the 70s and 80s, there were always two separate coaches. And the programs pretty much were separate, right?
Separate.
They didn't travel together, never had matches the same day in the same spot. When we practiced, we would practice, and then there'd be like an hour break, and then the women would come, and we didn't see them a lot, right? So the trend then went the other direction completely, and it was interesting where, there are very few programs now that are separate, and some of them I think are very healthy because you have somebody really focused on, one of the programs, not trying to combine it.
Absolutely. I will stress that, and maybe this is due to the history that Gilly and I have together, where when I started in 04, he was the first person I played on the Penn squash courts. This is a funny story. Craig is trying to sort of suss me out once I arrive. Yeah. Literally first day. He's like, pretty decent player. I'm like, I haven't played a lot this summer. I've been coaching at Princeton squash camps. He's like, why don't you play against the sophomore on my team? I said, okay. Well, it was about 98 degrees in the squash courts. Gilly
is
super fit, super fast. I think the first game was close, and then he, proceeds to, win the next two very quickly. But the fact that we've known each other for so long, been so close, just because he is managing the men and I manage the women doesn't mean that our programs aren't integrated and close. One of the things that we get a lot of feedback from recruits, those that come to Penn and then those that choose other places. One of the things they seem to like is that our programs are linked. And close.
Yeah.
And we practice at the same time, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, which is nice.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah. Interesting. What was Craig like as a mentor? And like, how was he different, say, from Bob Callahan or,
Well, a lot like Frank Millett. I mean, I was so focused on winning and building the program as quickly as possible. I want to say by any means necessary. I'm not talking about recruiting violations or things like that, but I just really wanted us to move into that top tier of college squash as quickly as possible. So if anything, what he did for me, and I hope I provide the same sort of guidance for Gilly now, is he just told me often, take a deep breath, slow down. It's not that big of a deal. I remember him constantly saying, and I used to just chalk it up to him being Australian and just telling me, chill out. But the truth of the matter is, like any job, there are big problems and there are small problems. And the small problems are not ones that you want to concern yourself when really what's most important about what we're doing is mentoring young people, making sure that they develop life skills, that we use this great sport as a vehicle to help them become better people.
Better humans, yes.
And so he just reminded me of that. And we're still very close. I love that he's involved with U.S. squash and he pops down to Philly, not as regularly as he used to, but still down a lot.
He's one of the world's like great collectors of squash stuff. Was that happening when you were working with him? And like, would he be like, I just got this stamp from, you know, somewhere? Like, what was he talking about?
Quietly, yes. Yeah, he was collecting stuff, but I think most of it's in his house in Red Hook, New York.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. He's one of those great guys in the game. I mean, a lot like, you know, Frank, sort of a lifer that, you know, you were lucky to cross paths with.
Yeah, most people don't know he was one of the first pros
to come over.
Yeah, to come over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And worked at the Kenwood Club.
Right.
And they used to have a big women's pro tournament.
Yep.
You know, Michelle Martin, Sarah Fitzgerald, their era, I think.
Yeah. So you've now, basically 20 years now, you've been coaching college squash. You and I talked about this the other night, like what should we be doing? Like, what could we be doing to make, you know, it basically is the backbone of the game in America. It's the strongest part of our game that, you know, has helped us weather recessions and ups and downs the way other countries have really suffered and courts closed, clubs closed because of, you know, the changing economics of the game or society changing. And like college squash, right, we have so many courts, and more importantly, we turn out hundreds of players a year who leave college having never played before. They get into it and they continue playing the rest of their lives. So it's a huge backbone for our game. And yet, like, it could be a lot better.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I think at the highest level, well, squash at the college level has never been better in terms of the product we're producing. The Americans are better than
ever.
There are so few countries now that don't want their best players to come. There are still some
pockets
where they want to
keep them
so that they can train them. And I get that and makes sense. But I remember when I started 20 years ago and went to World Juniors in Belgium, not as a coach or as a player, obviously, but just to recruit. I mean, it was like suggesting that these young people from Europe or Egypt or wherever come to the U.S., they thought I was nuts. And there were obviously a number at Trinity and a few at Harvard and Yale and some other places. But now the flow is completely reversed, where everybody wants to come to college squash. So I think in that sense, we're better than we've ever been. The other thing that I'm optimistic about in the future is that it took us, in my opinion, way too long to partner with U.S. Squash and way too long to combine the games or merge the men's and women's games. Yeah, work together.
Yeah.
And
well, that long time there was this dynamic of the men's and women's CSA kind of being separate.
They were separate. Very separate.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
I mean, you look like from afar, you're like, why? Like same thing like with U.S. squash and CSA. Like, should all be working together to, you know, have synergies.
Yeah, we're not big enough to work separately. And I mean in college coaches, we're a volunteer organization. My primary job is for Penn. It is not to grow college squash. Whereas if you think of what are the interests of college squash, they're aligned very closely with the interests of U.S. squash.
Yep.
I think that if you look at the growth of our sport compared to, especially, I'll cite lacrosse or
rowing.
I mean, I think lacrosse has over 300 varsity programs. And if you look at where they were in 1980, actually took some notes.
Even when you were in college in the 90s,
yeah. Right? Rowing has 48 had 48 men's and 43 women's varsity sports in varsity programs in 1981. Today they have 77 and 155. So their growth is decent, but not substantial. Lacrosse had 138 men and 105 women's programs in 81. They now have 380 and 505. That was in 2017. So I guess...
Oh, and then, so it's even more now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
500.
Yes.
And they went from 100 to 500.
And I'm just citing those two sports because they're sort of associated as they're kind of thought of as Northeast corridor sports.
They were.
And you look at really what we did in squash for 100 years, it's kind of not much. We're still hovering around this 40 number. And I don't think we need to get to 100 or 150 like that. But I think we have an opportunity now, especially with squash being in the Olympics, to grow the game. And we need to, instead of just sort of sitting around waiting for things to happen, waiting for John Fry to go to Drexel,
right,
or who's the gentleman at UVA that started their program. I mean, we can't wait for these just lucky breaks.
Fluky things to happen.
We need to go out and find someone for Stanford to play on the West Coast. We need to get squash at the University of Washington or Cal or UCLA or USC. We can't be reliant upon Mark flying his team over three times a year to get 15 matches. I mean, that's not sustainable. You know, we have an opportunity in the ACC with UVA having an unbelievable program. Is we, and I said we meaning like U.S. squash, the CSA, we have to help. We have to go out and recruit. We have to recruit new schools just like we recruit players from around the world. Because I do think there's a great opportunity. For those that haven't been to a college squash match, it is so much fun. I mean, it's unlike anything. I guess the closest I could ever compare it to would be when like Barada and John Power and Peter Nichol were playing at the Pyramids, and you saw those videos. That's the energy that it's comparable to.
Yeah, I mean the face painting, the signs, the yelling. You know what I love is you go to a pro match and a lot of times it's very quiet. You know, and you want you want people really fired up. A little bit, maybe they're rooting the wrong way. They're cheering when there's an error. But you know, it's exciting, and you know there'll be 1,500 people there, and like you know, people are passionate, and alums are there, and we have to harness that energy, and market it so like let the world see that energy.
Yeah, absolutely, and I do want to commend the CSA and U.S. Squash because what they're doing, what we are doing this year for the first time ever, well, not for the first time ever. I think in 2015, the men's teams and women's teams were combined once, but that was a one-off. We are combining the team championships, top 12 men's teams, top 12 women's teams. And this is something that a number of people have pushed, but especially John Nimick, and he's done an unbelievable job of presenting squash to the world in the United States for 30 some odd years, and he recognizes that there's so much more we can do. So we will have our CSA championships this year with the top 12 teams starting on Thursday, sort of play-in matches, and then quarters, semis, and finals.
Right.
And it'll be the men and women on the same weekend. So
and same for facility.
Same facility at the Spectre Center. So it's going to be a great spectacle of squash for anyone that hasn't seen a college squash match or is remotely interested. They should come because it'll be a real sight to see, I think.
But we need it. We need like that's the top, and we need to expose that more. And at the same time, we need to like dig down to the bottom and get more. A lot of these colleges have courts, or they can access courts somewhere. We need to get more club teams playing, and then, of course, convert the clubs to varsity. I mean, rowing and lacrosse must have been some of that grassroots going, like as you said, being intentional, going to a conference and going to those schools and saying, you know, like let's get started, let's build a club team. And it won't be that strong in the beginning, but like we'll help support you as you get into it.
Yeah, I think people much smarter than me. We need to figure out what our strategy is. I mean, there are plenty of club teams out there that we can boost up. There are schools sort of geographically located, like I mentioned on the West Coast, that we could target. I know there have been some efforts with some HBC historically black colleges that might be interested in starting programs. So I'm not exactly sure what the strategy is. I just know that we need to be very focused and intentional about our efforts. I think we need to do fundraising. Those programs or those alums that are currently solely focused on their institution need to think more broadly, and we need to go out and find the alums of these schools where we think there might be the opportunity to have a great program, and we need to get them actively involved. And just, I mean, actively involved basically means giving money and time and calling, leaning on the athletic directors at these places, leaning on those that are on the board of trustees, folks that can really make things happen.
Yeah, you've seen this, like, those conversations within the institution. Like, it's like an aircraft carrier, and it's hard to move it at all. And if you're saying, like, add something, they're like, you know, that's a nightmare for me. So you have to figure out how to make that, you know, acceptable and palatable.
Absolutely. But I think if we come together and if we put together the statistics of how college squash players do in life and how dedicated they are to their institutions,
and they bring how diversity.
Accomplished, how accomplished they are. Yeah. I mean, we've got.
Yeah. You have kids from how many countries on the Penn's men's and women's team?
I mean, I don't know.
Right, I mean, like 20-odd countries over your 20 years, right?
Oh, I don't think it's quite 20, but England, Scotland, Malaysia, India, Egypt.
Right now.
Croatia. This is right now.
Wow.
Canada. Quite a number.
Right, so you're bringing that to the school as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you end up having conversations with your brother about SEA and college squash and how, you know, that wing of what happens with squash in America is really is integrated into, you know, what's happening with the CSA, what's happening with college squash, what's happening with Penn squash. Do you guys talk about that at Thanksgiving?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the challenge there is finding institutions where these young people continue to play.
Right.
My understanding from him is that the challenge when they're younger is getting the those squash players the instruction that they need to be able to compete with all the kids at in the other places where they're
getting a lot more lessons.
Yeah.
A lot more support.
So it's, you know, that's your interview with Tim about how to do it. But what I want to try to help with is provide more institutions where there are places for these people to go
to play in college.
Yeah
exactly. Right.
Yeah, and they're getting into colleges at a much higher rate than their peers. But I think a lot of them don't have the opportunity to play club squash and not varsity squash, which isn't quite the same.
Right. So what do you think the Olympics is going to do for Penn squash? Anything directly?
Well,
you might get some, like you might have a kid from China like 5 years from now.
Well, we have a young lady from Croatia who's playing three on our team and her name is Franca, and we already mentioned it to her. I said, what do you think? I mean, is this possible? And I don't know what the criteria will be, but our goal would be to help in any way our current student athletes or even our alums. I mean, I mentioned Ali to you earlier. I mean, his rise in the PSA rankings has been meteoric. So maybe there's an opportunity for him to play in the Olympics. We would love to have some of our alumni in competing. I'll certainly be there watching.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. July 2028 is marked out already.
Yeah, absolutely.
What you built an incredible facility. So you're part of this little nexus of 37 singles courts within, you know, a couple minute walk. And how is, you know, as much as we lament the loss of the old Ringe courts and how they were really one of the most iconic places to play squash and so many great matches happened there over the many decades, but now the new facility is incredible. And how is that sort of in the last couple of years, you know, with the pandemic easing and the facility opening, how's that kind of changed your life? You have a better office, maybe, but
yeah. First of all, it was an amazing project to have the opportunity to participate in. Mm. It's not sort of what you sign up for, where your job is to recruit and mentor and coach. Obviously, coming to Penn in 2004, knowing what Ringe was like when it was all hardball courts, and that was the coolest, the most fun place to be and to play in junior squash.
Yeah,
I was before coming over this morning. I was thinking about how I've been at Penn for 20 years. The first big junior tournament I ever played was in 1983 at the Penn courts.
Hunter Lot.
So I walk in the snow. Yeah, the Hunter Lot, and I see this looked like something where gladiators would be. It looks like the Colosseum in Rome. And it was awe-inspiring. So when we did the renovation, one of the things I did was call a bunch of our alums who had played in Ringe and said, what did you love about it? You know, some of the feedback I got, remember Ned saying it wasn't fancy, right? It was very functional. Mm. There was a verticality to it. So there were some elements that we tried to maintain.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that they did an unbelievable job of, which not everyone thinks about when they build squash courts, especially architects who are more interested in the wow factor, but we as squash people, we like going to squash facilities where we can circulate. And that's one of the things that they did a great job at the Spectre Center.
Yeah.
You need an outlet. You need a way in the middle of the winter when everyone's got the flu. You need a way to escape. This is something that architects don't think about. So that was one of the things about Ringe that was special. And so we tried to, I think we accomplished that with our
new facility. It's so funny because it is, you go down there and the conversations you're having and you're able to watch four or five matches all at once. And you're chit chatting, and it's extremely there's a great flow there in the front with the two glass courts.
Yeah, we're thrilled. It's also neat because our student athletes, if you were to come up on a Wednesday in January in the middle of the day when classes resume, you would see our students there.
Is there a club team at Penn?
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm saying our student athletes, when they aren't practicing,
your players,
they pop in. I mean, the proximity to the center of campus it's really close, which is a nice thing. But so they're in each team has a team room. So they're kind of in and out of there all day, whether it's hitting on their own or just, you know, taking a nap in the team room or something. But we didn't envision that it would be a place where they would spend so much time. And that's a great thing because it gives us more access to
more time with them.
Yeah, checking in, make sure that they're doing okay.
Because half your job at least is not about their on court stroke production movement. It's about
totally
where they are, right? And so if you can have those touch points, 5 minutes here, 1 minute there, 10 minutes, you know, that you're really able to help them more because you know them better. If they're coming around more. So they're coming around a lot more than they were 20 years ago with Ringe not having the same space.
They
always hang around.
But it's a thing that Gilly and I and Stuart, we notice that they're sort of in and out all day. We're very lucky to have it. We love it. We love the relationship we have with Drexel and with the Spectre Center. And I can't tell you how many December weekends I spent in New Haven at the U.S. Junior Open. So it's kind of nice that
you were driving around to like five different schools, you know, courts. You're just constantly.
Yeah.
So having it, and now you're a father of kids playing squash, so that's like a whole separate ball of wax.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's great. They're young, so they're just getting started. So if I am going to a tournament to watch the 17s or the 19s, I'll typically wear my Penn gear. But when I go just with one of our sons, who are in the 13s and 15s now, I just dress like a normal person and get to watch and observe and see how U.S. squash has changed. I will say that there's a lot of tension at those tournaments when kids get started, and it seems to ease up a little bit as they get older, which is a good thing. But I would, if any parent of a young squash player were to ask my advice, I would suggest to them that it is really just a sport for life, and it's the more fun it is for them, the better they'll be over the long term. But I will say this, because everyone's favorite thing to do in squash in America is complain about U.S. squash, but you and I have perspective, and we can remind them that when we played junior squash, the rankings were done by four or five people sitting around a table in Payne Whitney Gym in April. And there was one appeal process, and there was zero technology. There was no refereeing, and I know that's a topic that everyone's concerned about.
What do you see? So were you in college when there was no referees, right?
Correct.
Yeah, exactly. You're not. So that's what we had, right? It was
self-officiating.
Self-officiating. And of course now there's multi levels. You know, sometimes there's guys in red shirts doing it, and you know, otherwise the players are. So that's totally changed, and maybe not for the better entirely, right?
Oh, 100% for the better. I think this is what getting to go to junior squash tournaments and see how much things have evolved.
Yeah.
From a parent perspective, is incredible. And when people complain about stuff, I just
40 years ago it was a little different.
I just sit there and listen and say, you know, it's not all that bad. And are the referees perfect? They are not perfect at any level, but I mean, this would be a question for U.S. squash. How many certified referees do they have now? I guarantee you it's more than they've ever had before, and I guarantee you that that it's probably more than any other country in the world. So we're making progress. It's always going to be an imperfect sport. When you and I go play and we share the same space, and our goals are very different. Your goal is to beat me, and mine is to beat you. I mean, we're going to have a little bit of conflict. So, but I think U.S. squash is doing an unbelievable job. I'll give you one other example. So last year, our youngest got invited to play in the British Junior Open, but by like very thin margins. We were stunned that, you know, didn't even expect that he would be in the running. Yeah, thank you. And so I don't review all the emails, but my wife says to me before we go to Birmingham, she goes, well, you don't have to coach Sam. And I kind of laugh and say, that's ridiculous. And they say, oh, no, U.S. squash has coaches. They provide coaches for you. And even though I've been to World Juniors like something like 11 times.
You've gone 11 times.
Either as a player, as a coach, or a recruiter. Right. Yeah, I think it's 11.
I'd have to count.
It is a lot. Been to Poland twice. But anyway, lots of fun places. Hong Kong twice. Anyway, so I'd never been to the British Open, and we didn't play when we were young. So it was my first time going to the British. U.S. squash says, we'll coach your children. And I ignore the fine print, of course, thinking, there's no chance. Like, he's the fifth qualifier. Like, they're not going to want to focus on the fifth qualifier in his age group. I used to work for U.S. squash as a national team coach. Of course they're going to let me coach my own son. And they kind of very nicely, they sort of let it be known, no, that's not the case. And so this is just another example of how squash has evolved in the U.S.
Well, we sent 10 coaches over.
It's unbelievable. Linda was like an air traffic controller. This was last year. The internet goes down, or they had all sorts of communication issues during the British. Yep. And so she was sending coaches to all these different venues, and you literally didn't have to lift a finger as a parent. And I thought, wow, this is an example of how we are evolving, and one of the reasons why we are competing at a high level, because we do have a great structure. Is it perfect? No, but we're getting better all the time. And I just thought that was really nice. And you know what? It was great for me because I got to go and just be the supportive dad and not have to worry about messing up Sam's chances in between games.
You can even wear a pen shirt once in a while.
I guess. Yeah.
Sure.
Outside the Glass would like to thank our producer, Grant Irving, and all our loyal listeners who have reviewed and rated the podcast, shared their enthusiasm for it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and more importantly, have spread the word by talking about Outside the Glass with their squash friends. And may all your Knicks roll.